Welcome back to the podcast, everyone. On today's episode, we'll be diving deep into knowledge graphs to understand how they can be used to turbocharge search and what they might mean for the future of AI. And for that, I'll be speaking to Mike Tung, the CEO of Diffbot, which is a startup that's built the world's largest knowledge graph. To do that, they've had to overcome a whole bunch of really interesting technical challenges, including becoming one of a handful of companies that actually crawls the entire web to create a massive data set of billions and billions of pages. Mike has fascinating insights into the problems with search today, what language models can and can't do, and how knowledge graphs might figure into the future of AI. And he was kind enough to share them with me on this episode of the Towards Data Science podcast. Talking about this just before we started recording, but I always like to start to talk to startup founders because I find there is so much hype in terms of AI capabilities and so many question marks about where the real value is being created that it's useful to talk to people who have to sell the stuff for a living, to people who will really pay money for a real product. Mm-hmm. So thank you for making the time.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm happy to dive deeper into that. We're at Diffbot, we can probably get into more of this later, but Diffbot's one of the few, I would say, startups that does original research ourselves, where we publish work and work with the academic community, but we're also like a profitable startup that is funded primarily by our customers that are getting value from our AI.
And is that weird? Like culturally, do you find your team is like, you're managing this, I guess, a team with two different compositions, like there's like an academic side and then there's more of a sales side?
So not really at Diffbot. So I would say we hire people that are sort of PhD caliber people, but also know how to write production level code. So we have the people that are doing the cutting edge research at Diffbot are also actually implementing the system, right? And okay. We find actually a lot of machine learning research these days is in a sense engineering, right? But of course it's hard to find those kind of people, right? That have the PhD in ML, but yet can write fast code and scalable code at the scale we operate at.
And what do they usually look like? Like when you find somebody who has that skill set, do they tend to come from a certain kind of background or is it pretty generic?
So we use actually the Diffbot knowledge graph. We've used it to find a lot of the people that work at Diffbot, right? So Diffbot is a collection of about 40 or so experts in machine learning. And for some of these skills that we use in our company, there's only a couple of people in the world that have that skill, right? Like a knowledge fusion, entity linking, record linking. Right. So a guy in our entity linking team wrote one of the state of the art papers in entity linking in his PhD and is working on that at Diffbot. One of the researchers that work in information extraction, like web extraction, she did her PhD in event web page extraction. She's probably the only person in the world that has a PhD in that and has taken that work and built a production level system at Diffbot. Okay. Right. So it's kind of like I like to call it kind of like an X-Men, and we have kind of Cerebro, the system that can find the mutants around the world.
Well, actually, that's as good as a tie-in I can think of to actually, you know, what this is, what is special about this, what makes it so unique. Obviously, in your case, Diffbot is built on a sort of like knowledge graph system. Yeah. Maybe for people who aren't familiar, as you indicated, with knowledge graphs, could you start off just by explaining what is a knowledge graph and what makes it so interesting and powerful?
Yeah, that's great. So there's basically two things I think worth saying about what is a knowledge graph. One is sort of, you know, the definition that you normally hear of, which is a knowledge graph is a graph, you know, it encodes knowledge. A graph is nodes and edges, right? And the nodes in a knowledge graph are entities. So real world people, places, and things. And the edges are relationships, right? So it's a way of modeling data. Such that you have these nodes, which represent real world concepts, right? Like people, places, products, articles, events, for example, and the relationship between those are the edges. So for example, Mike Tung is, I'm a person, Diffbot is a company. Those are two nodes. And the relationship is Diffbot is my employer, right? Or also that I founded Diffbot. So those are all edges between those two nodes. So in a sense, that's what a knowledge graph really is. In a sense, that definition is not, I guess, all there is to it, because, you know, that actual concept of a knowledge graph is really quite old, right? Like even back in the 70s when they were, when relational databases came to the fore, people were already thinking about concepts like that, right? So really what's new about knowledge graphs and why it's such an exciting field now, it basically in the last 10 years, So basically, like in the early 2010s, Google launched the Google Knowledge Graph. And so the other answer I could give you is that Knowledge Graphs is really like a marketing phrase, right, that Google came up with when they launched the Google Knowledge Graph. And that sort of like coalesced this community, sort of a mix of semantic web people, people that worked in like formal logics, and people that worked in machine learning together, right, into this what's called Knowledge Graph community today, right? And I think Gardner says it's sort of like at the peak of its hype cycle right now. And a lot of papers, right, at top NLP conferences are about knowledge and how to use knowledge graphs in AI systems. So it's definitely a hot topic now.
And could you speak to the productionization side of it, or the like turning it into a product side of things?
Yes.
So what is the Google Knowledge Graph as consumed by a user? What does it look like to me when I consume its output?
Yeah. So when you query Google, you'll notice like the classic kind of Google organic results on the left side, right, which are just kind of like those blue links, right, and with the title and the snippet, right, that's contextually generated from your query. And then on the right side, you'll see this what's called the knowledge panel, right, and the origin of that basically came from a startup that they acquired called MetaWeb, right, that made this knowledge graph, right, called Freebase. And so if you type in, you know, like Joe Biden or Barack Obama, you'll see their name, their picture. Actually, the pictures largely come from Google image search, but the facts about the entity, right, like when they were in office, when they were born, those are all quote unquote facts that come from the Google Knowledge Graph. And your question about, you know, how is this productized, right? Like how do businesses benefit from this, right? So there's all sorts of different kinds of vendors in the space, right? So there's people that produce the databases that power knowledge graphs. So there's graph database companies, right, like Neo4j, right, which recently, you know, raised quite a lot of money. And there's companies that provide consulting services to help you like implement a knowledge graph inside your organization, right, to help you internally model your data as a knowledge graph, right? So I can think of like Cambridge Semantics, right, or data.world that helps you build like data catalogs around that. And then what Diffbot's role is we have a knowledge graph. And so we actually crawl the entire web like Google does, and we build a knowledge graph, and we actually provide our knowledge graph, our knowledge as the service. So the actual data itself, right? So I would say there's very few companies sort of in our camp where it's actually a knowledge graph that you can query and pay to query. Yes, Google has a knowledge graph API, but it's not very good, and it doesn't actually return back a lot too much structured information.
Well, and I'm curious about the crawling aspect too. Like, obviously, the internet is a very massive thing. So what goes into crawling the entire internet, and why is it that like Diffbot, along with I guess Microsoft and Google, are like some of the few companies who are actually doing that?
Yeah. So I mean, the internet is quite, as you've mentioned, it's quite a lot involved in crawling the whole web, which is why there's a very few companies that do it today. People might not even be aware, but even companies like DuckDuckGo and stuff, they don't do their own crawl of the entire web, right? So DuckDuckGo is actually one of Diffbot's customers, like uses Bing's crawl of the web. So I would say it's sort of rarefied air that you're actually crawling the web. And as to like, why is Diffbot able to do it? We're only like 40 people, you know, over here in Menlo Park. It's really because we hired this one a guy in our company, Matt Wells, who was the founder of a search engine before. So he was one of the core like five engineers at InfoSeek. This kind of I don't know if you remember the era where there were actually multiple search engines and like AltaVista and Excite and stuff.
Ask Jeeves,
yeah, Dogpile, Mama. He basically was one of those really five engineers. I think one of his cubemate was Robin Lee, which went off and started Baidu. But he went to Albuquerque, New Mexico, and founded Gigablast. He wrote basically, you know, over a million lines of C and C++ code and figured out how to crawl the whole web.
By the way, what goes into that? So like what is the hard thing about crawling the web? Like just explain it like I'm 5 cents.
Yeah. I would say that crawling the web today is much harder than it was in the 90s and the 2000s too, because the web itself is much larger today. Right. So it's sort of the barrier to entry becomes higher and higher each year. Generally, the hard part about it is the distributed systems aspect of it. So you have all of these nodes that are, you can't crawl the entire web from basically a single machine just because it wouldn't fit in the the disk space, right, on a single node, right? So you generally have multiple nodes, you know, and it's the coordination of all those nodes, which is really challenging, right? And
how big is the internet, by the way? Like how many?
Well, the real answer is that the internet is actually infinite, right? Because there's these links on the web that are dynamically generated, right? So think about every time you see like a calendar widget on a web page and there's a next button. That next button actually goes to infinity, right? So there's actually, you could follow that forever and you would never reach the end of time. So the kind of, you know, short answer is that the internet is infinite. However, I would estimate you probably need about 1 billion pages to get like the most popular pages you would expect in an index to be in your index. And you probably need like around 40 billion pages to have like the long tail, right? That random Stack Overflow question that you're looking for some syntax error. To get that into the index, you probably need to get to like around 40 billion or so pages, I would assume. But the major internet companies, Google and Bing, no longer even publish like how many results match your query anymore, because in a sense, it doesn't matter at a certain level where it's just more about relevance, right? Getting back to your question about, you know, why is it hard? It's because A, the web is bigger. There's also a lot of spider traps and random kind of pitfalls in crawling the web. There's infinite loops that you might get into. There's black holes, there's honeypots.
Can you explain some of those things? Like what would an infinite loop look like?
Yeah, so, one example is just like that calendar widget, right? If you had like a pretty naive algorithm that's just following the links, you would just get stuck in that forever. And then your index would eventually just be full of these like calendar pages, right? That have very low value instead of getting to the high value parts of the web, right?
So you mentioned a honeypot too. Sorry, that just sounds kind of cool.
Yeah, well, so there's spider traps, right? So there's lots of spam on the web. That's one reason why the web is so much bigger actually than before. It makes it harder because there's a lot of spam and content farms. And you know, there might be a honeypot kind of site, which is like if you follow a link that only like a spider can see, that the human visitor can't see, then it basically black holes your IP address, right? And then you see all kinds of weird stuff when you're crawling the web at our scale. Random pages that return corrupt PDF files, and the information just all in these corrupt PDF files.
And do you handle each of these edge cases as they come up, like with a patchwork, or is there, I don't know, are there rules that help? I guess some of this is proprietary too.
Well, so Matt, when he was developing GigaBlast, basically over a decade plus, already found a lot of the edge cases. So when he joined our company, you know, he brought along that, you know, million plus C++ code base. And so we were just able to attach our machine learning technology to ride on top of that crawl. And that's how we're as a small startup able to do what like other web giants or teams of hundreds of people are able to do.
Okay. So you have this just fantastic piece of engineering basically backing you. How do you then go from, you know, we're sitting on whatever it is, however many billion pages that you're staring at to building and populating this, what must be a massive knowledge graph, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We have today the world's largest automated knowledge graph. So it's over 10 billion nodes, you know, well over your trillion edges. And it's the only knowledge graph of its kind that's being really built without a human being in the loop in a full end-to-end automated system. And that's at a level of production quality that we have paying customers, you know, using it and paying us to query it. So to summarize kind of the pipeline, which happy to go more in depth into any of these things, is we crawl pages, we render those pages in a real web browser. So we have like a fork of basically Chromium, which is the rendering engine that Chrome and Safari use, that has been optimized for machine learning. So it's like 10x faster, and it dumps out all the features from the page. So we are able to see from a page, like its pixels, the RGB alpha values, the position of all the elements on the page, like what fonts, what colors they use, also the text of the page and all the variables that the programmers use to make the page. And we're able to take those as basically a long, you know, string of this in this joint feature space and do classification. And we're able to classify, okay, is this a product page or an article page or a person page or a company page, right? Or an event page. So we have these top level types. And then we're also able to do automated extraction. So for a product, what's the price? What's the SKU? What's the MPN?
And for that, do you just use a language model?
Yeah. So we also, we build machine learning classifiers. We use tons of language models. That machine learning classifier uses the language as a set of features. It also uses the visualness of where it is, right? So for example, if you were to consider extracting the price of a product, right? It's not only about the language model, like what's the currency symbol, right, and the words are around it, but also it's likely price buttons look a certain way, right? Like they're located near the shopping cart, you know, they're even on a Japanese product page without any knowledge of the language, you could generally tell what the price is of the product.
You're doing basically multimodal learning here with combining like language data with image data and maybe some other stuff too.
Yes, basically our machine learning is classifying in this joint feature space, right? That includes the language, it includes the image, it also includes the structured data, like the layout information in the rendering process.
Wow.
And it includes the state space of the programmer variables and stuff, like what's used in the CSS and ID paths in the page.
What does that architecture look like? I'm so curious, like for it to be like, or are we talking about like a transformer net of the sort that we've seen work on multimodal data at like OpenAI and other places or something else?
Well, like in most, I would say applied machine learning systems, it's really a combination of what works best in each of those domains, right? So for language models in particular, we use, you know, large pre-trained language models that we fine tune. We also train some of those ourselves because we have a copy of the web in our data center. So we're able to train our own language models. A lot of handwritten features. I'd say the most popular kinds of base learners we use at DiffBot are like neural network based models, as well as gradient boosted trees, right? And decision and random forests, like tree based models.
Gotcha.
So yeah. And then ensembling those two, you can usually get to the state-of-the-art level of precision and recall.
Wild. Well, there's so many interesting questions that we could go into here, but I think one of them is, you know, what makes this moment in time special? Like, why is it that all of a sudden, and I think you've hinted at it, I mean, is it just neural nets are that good now, or AI is that good that we can extract subject to verb object from a sentence and do all these interesting things?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. I think part of it is like, you know, if you look at recent NLP conferences, right, like ENML, NLP and ACL, you see a large proportion of papers have like knowledge in the title now, right? And it's like, what's underlying that trend? I think one reason is explainability, right? So the way, as AI becomes more prevalent in many of the intelligent systems, knowledge graphs are a very natural way to connect deep learning based models, which are in a sense very opaque, right? Because they're all just weights, to a way to explain to the human operator, like what's the reason why it's making a certain prediction, right? And knowledge graphs are a very easy way to inspect, first of all, what is the knowledge that the system knows, right? And also incorporate those facts in the explanation. And it's a way of actually injecting domain knowledge and expertise into the system. And I think you've seen a lot of these papers because a lot of people are seeing success in that when you inject this domain knowledge, it's actually making these scores higher, right, on these academic benchmarks.
Interesting. So it's like the fact that there's renewed interest from the interpretability, explainability side of things that's now unlocked all these techniques and created a bunch of people who can implement them?
Yeah. And also there's just so much you can do with just, you know, buying more GPUs, right? And training the architecture deeper. I think a few labs are just going more and more in that route, but it reaches diminishing returns at some point, right? And so
that ties into a hardware question I did have as well, which is like, you know, we know that GPUs are great for training deep neural nets. What about knowledge graphs? Like, do you get the same speed boost from GPUs?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I would say there's many, many areas where technology developed outside of DiffBot helps improve the KPIs and performance of our knowledge graph. I would say only one of them is GPUs, because GPUs allow you to search higher dimensional spaces faster, right? So that you're able to build better and better language models, train better and better embeddings, for example. But we benefit from other hardware improvements as well. Like I would say even more so improvements in SSD. So, we buy a lot of Samsung SSDs, lots and lots of SSDs. We run our own data center where we crawl the web out of, and we serve the knowledge graph out of. So any kind of technological improvements in the latency of SSDs is a game changer. It means you can store more of the knowledge graph on faster media, and it translates directly into being able to traverse the graph faster and use more of the graph when computing embeddings. It translates directly into the latency that our users perceive when they query the default knowledge graph, right? It's largely gated by the speed of those SSDs.
Can you elaborate a little bit on the connection between like embeddings and the knowledge graph itself? Like I understand the kind of information extraction stage where you're pulling data, turning a sentence into an embedding and so on. But do you mean that there's a layer of that on top of the knowledge graph itself?
Yeah, so there's, I think a lot of the community knows about language model embeddings, right? But then there's this other area called knowledge graph embeddings, right? Mm. So a language model embedding is basically taking text, right, and embedding that into a fixed length vector. But how do you embed a node in a knowledge graph into a vector, for example, right? So how do you embed the Joe Biden node of a knowledge graph into an embedding? That's a very popular area of research now called knowledge graph embeddings. And so we train embeddings for every node in our 10 billion node knowledge graph. And we use these embeddings in various ways. So one downstream user of the embedding is entity linking. So when we are reading information on the web, we're reading text. When we see, okay, let's say like Sam Smith mentioned in some text, we need to resolve that to an entity in the knowledge graph, right? And there's probably 50,000 Sam Smiths in the default knowledge graph. All right, so the embedding of each of those nodes is a very prominent feature used in the entity linking model, right? Another thing way embeddings are used is actually directly in querying. So if you, you can ask the default knowledge graph, give me all companies that are based in California that are similar to this set of entities, where this set of entities is our customer base, for example, or our portfolio companies, if we're like an investor or a VC, right? That's basically like entity similarity, right? And so the embedding of an entity is a key feature in calculating the similarity at query time between to serve and answer that kind of a query.
And I guess a key factor in forming those embeddings must be just like the linkages between like that node and like the overlap between linkages of two different nodes, say, tells you something about how similar they are.
Exactly. Yeah. There's many features that go into computing these embeddings, right? It's both what are its edges in the graph, right? But also like if there's like a description attached to that entity, right? Think about like a Wikipedia kind of entity. It has like a Wikipedia article, right? So there's all these textual features that can also go into the graph embedding.
Well, interesting.
If the Sam Smith that's a football player and the Sam Smith that's a software engineer, they have different skills, right? So that's a property of the entity that weighs into how that embedding should be calculated, right?
And like, how do you make sure that redundancies don't happen or that, you know, the same person isn't, degeneracies and redundancies, if that makes sense.
Yes, totally. Yeah, that's also an ongoing research area at DeFi. So we have a guy who owns that. It's called record linking at DeFi. So basically we extracting from the web is not sufficient, right? Because entities, there's not a one-to-one mapping between entities and web pages, right? Like if you think about the latest iPhone, right? It's for sale on many pages in the web. So you're going to extract the same information from many pages. I myself might have my academic homepage at Stanford. I might have be on a DiffBot website. I might be on like a professional social network. It's got to recognize that those are all the same person and link them together. Otherwise, there will be just a whole bunch of duplicates when you query, right, in the DiffBot knowledge graph. And so we have what we call record linking model that does this at web scale. And you can imagine if you just naively do this, compare every entity to every other entity, it's like a 10 billion square operation, right? So you have to think about ways of blocking, it's what it's called, and hashing so that you can do these comparisons and all to all in this much smaller space.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, there's so many, it kind of reminds me of the early days of neural networks, where there were so many open questions, so many inefficiencies that were buried in ways that weren't obvious in like the way these systems worked. And there we go.
And I would argue these topics that I'm talking about, there's not enough research in them because it's very hard to study them in academia, right? Because like, if you're a PhD student and you're interested in studying record linking, right, or knowledge fusion, how do you do that? So one of the goals of our company is actually to provide open access to the knowledge graph to academic labs so that, you know, those researchers can directly like SSH into our servers and conduct experiments. Yeah.
Okay. So that's interesting, especially because, and it ties into where I was going to go next, which is this kind of comparison with OpenAI and GPT-3, which, you know, it seems like on the surface, these are doing very different things, but, you know, GPT-3 can be used for search. There is some overlap there. OpenAI has talked about making this, you know, accessible and does make it accessible to research institutions. You've talked about the same thing. I'm curious about what you see as some of the key differentiators between like using Diffbot as a search tool and using GPT-3 as a search tool.
Yeah, I would say the fundamental high order bit is language models like GPT-3 are, if you consider what's the language modeling objective function, right? It's to try to train the next, it's try to predict the next word in the sequence, right?
Yeah.
So the stuff that's generated from GPT-3 is trying to basically sound convincing, basically. But there is no factuality objective in GPT-3. There's no guarantee that what GPT returns is actually the right answer or the correct answer, right? I'll tell you a quick anecdote, if I may, which is when GPT-3 launched, there were a lot of these startups and stuff like making these demos, right, of GPT-3. And one of those demos that got like a lot of retweets on Twitter is one where you basically have a spreadsheet, right? And then you could ask, GPT-3 is basically filling in the answers to various cells in the spreadsheet, right? Like what is the founding date of Alaska? And what is the population of like Montana or something like that in these spreadsheets? And this got a lot of retweets and a lot of engagement. Everyone was saying, oh, this is awesome. This is so cool. I'd love to use this. But I looked more closely at the answers in the cell and they were all wrong answers. And then no one seemed to have caught that because GPT-3 is incredibly good at fooling humans, right? And producing the next word that appears to be correct, right? But it's not explainable. Like it's not citing any source as to where the answer information came from, right? So the GPT-3 demo showed, okay, Alaska joined in like 1912, was founded, but I think the right answer isn't like until the 1950s or something that Alaska actually joined, right?
Yeah, so like GPT-3 basically tells you what some human, it answers the question, what would some human on the internet probably write as the answer to this question, which is often not the real answer to the question.
Exactly, yeah. What flows the best, basically, right? So GPT-3 is really good at fluency, for example, right? And producing like it's really good at fiction, right? Producing a story about unicorns and stuff, right? But it's not so useful in business tools, right? Like if you're like a data analyst or a salesperson, you actually care about it being the right answer, you know, right? So we were able to produce a demo of that where actually it tells you the correct answer for when Alaska joined the Union and what is the population of Montana. And it also tells you the primary source of that answer on the web. So it tells you that this is the right answer. We have this amount of confidence in the answer. And it's according to Wikipedia, it's according to the census, it's according to the site, and we can trace it and tell you because we have the property of data provenance in our knowledge graph, why we believe that's true.
Where does that uncertainty measurement come from? Like, is there a simple way to explain it?
Sure, yeah. So it's essentially, there's a machine learning system that we call knowledge fusion, right? That's responsible for reconciling, right? Different extractions, basically different facts that come from different pages. Right. And so it's a machine learning model like anything else, but it also has the data provenance information. So it could tell you what are the inputs to that model. Right. So like the inputs to that model were these three pages. So as a human, you could audit that. Right. And so that metric is basically calculating what's the probability that this fact is likely to be true based on all the evidence we have.
What are some of the failure modes that a system like that exhibits? Like, are there kinds of facts that it tends to get wrong and be overconfident in, for example?
Yeah, the failure modes, I would say, basically is when you, a fact that has very few sources, right? So something that's like in the head is very easy to get correct, right? Like, when was Barack Obama born, right? There's just so many sources of that fact. There's so many reputable sources of that fact as well, right? That we calculate an origin trust for every site on the web. And that's one of the features into that input, right? But for something that's like very long tail, right? Like what is, when was I born, for example, right? Where I'm not a celebrity, right? Or where is
we'll
this one startup located,
do, but...
right? You know, something that's long tail where there's zero or no sources, then yeah, a common failure mode is you don't have a high degree of confidence of that fact. And if the only source is like a stale source, right? Then it's just the best it can do is kind of produce that stale data, but at least it can produce back a number that's telling the system's telling you it's not that confident. So you can calibrate that.
And so that origin trust metric that you mentioned is used as an input here to decide how much to trust each source.
Yes.
It seems like a really interesting thing to dive into, especially because, you know, we live in the world of fake news and all that, and everybody's debating how to assess the reliability of things.
Yeah.
What goes into that? Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah. So it's a very, very active area of research as well. But I guess to sum it up, you know, intuitively, why do we all trust like Wikipedia more than, let's say, a site that was just registered as in the Ukraine last week, that they just registered a domain name and it's just like a WordPress blog with, you know, with like 1,000 entries. And so you can imagine the track record of the origin of producing facts that agree with the other consensus facts from other trustworthy sources. So we sort of have like a PageRank-like algorithm that computes iteratively, you know, like kind of how much we should trust an origin. And so if it has a longer track record of producing facts that agree with the consensus, then we trust that origin more, right?
Oh, interesting. Mm-hmm. Okay. So this is like, I mean, unsurprisingly, I guess most search will be like this, but it is a sort of consensus biased thing because, you know, naturally that'll happen. Have you found any like interesting, I don't know, have you learned anything surprising about specific sources of truth or websites based on this metric?
Yeah. Yeah. I think working in this area, you can get into these very deep philosophical conversations about what is truth. You know, if everyone if we all have this shared hallucination about this one thing, then is it true or not true, right? Those are very difficult. One thing I've learned is generally, you know, intellectually, it's really, I guess, appealing to get hung up on some of those cases, but in actuality, it's sort of less of an issue. And it also has to do with the nature of, I think, our customers and how people most use the DiffBot knowledge graph for business purposes. They're not asking for things that are really that subjective. They're asking for things that there's like hard objective facts. And it's sort of not as big of an issue as you might think, right? Because we're not really trying to characterize all of the different opinions or stances people have in our knowledge graph. That's just not the purpose of our knowledge graph.
that's one virtue of not being Google. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's funny too, because like at a certain point, you know, people, it is of course legitimate to complain about biases and things like that in search and whatever else. But at a certain point, you do need a metric that scales well. And like consensus is one of few mechanisms we have for sense making. And it's like, yeah, you know, that's until we have AGI, that's sort of what
our internal benchmark is to be as good as a human researcher that's using a tool like Google and reading the pages that are in the search results and trying to basically synthesize what they've read into, you know, what's the right answer.
Okay, so this is why I love talking to startup founders, because you've sort of identified implicitly what your not what your competition is, but what activity you're trying to make more efficient. So it really is about not replacing search, but replacing the searcher.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, okay. I mean, I think one thing people should understand is Google is not actually a service that gives you the answer. It's actually more like you know, card catalog, if people remember those things in a library. So Google is the card catalog. It tells you pointers to basically books that you should read, but it doesn't read the books for you. You have to read all those links yourself and then come, you know, to what you think is the right answer to your question, right? DiffBot is going a step further. We're actually reading the books and we're actually trying to automate that mental activity of what we call research, which is combining the information from multiple sources to arrive at a piece of a structured answer.
Which is why I guess measures of confidence and signaling mm-hmm. measures of confidence is so important, because so important. Unlike Google, yes. you can't just be like, well, I gave you 10 things. And so what if like three of them were bad and you happen to read those? Like
really kind of, yeah. In a sense, the Google problem is easier because you return back basically a million results, right? And you just have to sort the results. And
yeah.
As long as the top 10 look reasonable, then the user's kind of, it's an okay result, right? You can, it doesn't have to be the best result that's at the very top. That could
yeah.
be. Yeah, for it to be a reasonable return.
That's really interesting, because it is its own kind of almost human machine interaction challenge on top of everything else, is like
totally.
How do you build trust in these systems? Mm-hmm. Have you learned anything interesting about that aspect, I wonder? Like, are there ways of conveying the uncertainty mm-hmm. in the results of these queries that work mm-hmm. better than others, or that are pathological from the standpoint mm-hmm. of building undue confidence?
Yeah, it depends on, I guess, what kind of user of Diffbot, right? If it's like a data scientist or someone who's technical, we have those kinds of users as well. They are very comfortable with the confidence scores and
yeah.
and thresholding it in a way that's appropriate for their application, right? Let's say if they are doing a trading, high frequency trading or like investment kind of applications, they might be able to tolerate some noisy data because the user of the Diffbot data is another machine learning model that's trying to make predictions, right? Whereas if it's an application where, let's say it's for sales and it's like a user-facing UI, right? They're sort of less tolerant of noise. So maybe they might set a much higher threshold, right? Or they need some way to just differentiate, to only get the trust, the information that will work for their application, right? Because they can't complicate the interface.
Yeah.
You know, too much. We have some consumer applications that use Diffbot. Like there's one, a wedding planning app, Zola. So the users just paste like these product links, and Diffbot extracts the product image and price, and it builds a wedding registry, right? So
oh, wow.
The person that's building the wedding registry isn't going to be looking at confidence intervals. They just want to make sure the picture's right, the price is right. And so it should only return if those fields have high confidence, and the other fields maybe don't matter because they're not used in that UI, right?
It's so hard to avoid philosophy in the space. yeah. So actually one question I have is as well with respect to the future of this technology, like mm-hmm. there's a narrative that's kind of forming. I mean, Rich mm-hmm. Sutton with the sort of bitter lesson argument mm-hmm. says like, okay, to get to AGI, we're going to make neural networks deeper and deeper and deeper, and we'll start combining RL with them and show them more data. And basically prosaic systems will give rise to AGI. What role do you see kind of graph databases playing like in the long-term future? Like, where do you see this stuff going?
So I'm not sure if I'm an adherent to that belief that just like a combination of these prosaic systems will lead to AGI and sort of lead to a system that has its own emotions and agency and kind of desires and is like directing the system. I don't actually see too many lines of research that are like leading me to believe that's just going to naturally emerge on its own. Our kind of future roadmap of Diffbot is to produce what we call a universal factoid question answering system. So it's not a system that has emotions or agency or anything like that. It's simply a system where you can ask it any factual question and it could tell you the answer to that question and why it believes that question is true. And you could pose it in natural language, right? Your own native language. So we don't think too much about like AGI, I guess, at Diffbot in general. But personally, yeah, I am interested in it. That's I think why a lot of us got into this field, right? I just don't personally believe that we're gonna give rise to an AGI just with kind of bigger and bigger deep learning systems.
Yeah, no, and that's exactly sort of what I was curious about, because mm-hmm. you know, when we look at things like GPT-3, mm-hmm. People sort of have to make a choice then of like where they think things are headed and what potential mm-hmm. is left untapped in different areas.
Yeah.
Really interesting to see knowledge databases as this sort of like not counter argument to that narrative, but just like, hey, if we're not really going to get there, we're going to mm-hmm. need other ways of doing things. Mm-hmm. Is there a way you think of using knowledge graphs as a way of doing knowledge discovery, like of creating
totally.
New knowledge? Yeah.
Totally. Yeah. So one future area, which, you know, I would say we're just starting to scratch the surface of is, you know, if you have all of this knowledge in one place, now what can you do that wasn't possible before?
Right.
So if you think about the Enlightenment, you know, there were certain eras in time where it was possible for sort of all of human knowledge to fit into a single human mind, right? You have
yes.
these very cross-disciplinary folks like Aristotle and stuff, right? And Leonardo da Vinci. we've now reached an era where that's no longer possible to actually contain multiple fields of knowledge in one person, right? We've reached the area of specialization. But if you can somehow build a universal knowledge graph, you can actually build a system, an artificial intelligence system, that is actually possible of computing across the sum of all of human knowledge for the first time ever, I would say. And it's fascinating to think about, like, what kind of new discoveries would a system like that enable, right? Like, could it find new therapies or new drugs that connect disparate areas of knowledge that were not connected in a single mind before, right? Can it find, can it figure out the mapping between Eastern and Western medicine, for example, right? Which is like would be a huge undertaking, right? Or what could one system do if it read the entirety of all scientific literature, right? And it could actually, for any given query, cross-check and tell you, like, okay, these are the publications that support that, and these are the publications that refute that, and here's the confidence we have in whether this particular drug might work or not work, right?
I mean, that sounds quite plausible, especially given that, you know, when you think about many, not all, but many of the biggest discoveries that we've made, especially technologies, not just science, like, they have come from interdisciplinary thinking, and somebody, you know, like a physicist stumbling into biology or chemistry saying, hey, you know, you should try applying this principle or whatever. That seems like a kind of knowledge creation that this system would be very capable of.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. Like, a lot of, I would say at DiffBot, I come from a family of basically biologists, and my family works in biotech. And so early on, I studied computational biology and analyzing protein sequences. And we use those kind of techniques to analyzing web pages at DiffBot. And I think I wouldn't have thought of that if I didn't
come from that background.
The web page, a PhD, is basically like a ribosome. It's submitting basically a sequence, from some source code. But it's we are also one of the first to really pioneer using treating web page extraction as a computer vision task, right? Doing this multimodal form of extraction, which someone who's only in like a single field might not have naturally like arrived at that, right?
Yeah, which is also something that I found really interesting, given I'm trying to remember if it was OpenAI Codex or anyway, some AI system that basically like reads websites by parsing the DOM. Mm-hmm. And in your case, you're explicitly choosing not to do that. You're using like the pixels.
We're using more than that. Yeah. So it's like it includes the DOM, but also more. It's like a joint feature space that includes all that, as well as the actual state of like the JavaScript V8 runtime engine and all of the HTTP headers and all that.
Wow. Yeah, that does sound like a grotesquely large engineering challenge. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
So what are some of the things in graph databases that you're excited about, like that are on the horizon, the sort of research questions that seem like they're the most tractable right now?
Well, one we sort of mentioned, which is like graph embeddings, right? So I don't think we've come up to the right algorithm for graph embeddings like we have for language model embeddings yet. So I think the academic community is still, which presents a huge opportunity, right? Because we haven't found sort of like the equivalent of like, here's the neural network for this space.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's super exciting because in a sense, graph embedding is in a sense, one of the key AI problems, which is knowledge representation, right? Like, how do you represent an entity in your brain, right? So it's one of like the grand AI problems in my view. Another big one I would say is knowledge fusion. So we don't yet have a grand unified theory of knowledge fusion. And I used to work in self-driving.
Like knowledge fusion?
Yeah. So knowledge fusion is basically you view the internet as the world's largest sensor. Every web page is a signal, basically a source of information. And knowledge fusion is fusing those signals to arrive at truth. Like, what are the facts?
Okay.
Right. And so that's a machine learning problem, a pretty well-defined, but there is no well-defined or I would say consensus method of fusing information to arrive at that. I can give you a contrast. So in the area of like self-driving cars, for example, where you're fusing like LiDAR and the cameras and radar and stuff, I would say there's more mature models and means of fusing the various different disparate kinds of sensor data, right? You have like some theory there, right? Like Kalman filters, for example, right? But in knowledge fusion, when let's say okay, what's the birth date of a person, or like how tall is this entity, or like, you know,
yeah,
you have different data types. Some are Booleans, some are strings, some are floats. And what's the unified way of fusing all those different like types together to arrive at a consistent estimate of the probability of the truth, right?
And so that seems like the feature extraction part of the kind of broader question of like, do we just use consensus as the mechanism to find truth, or do we use something else?
So consensus is like only one way of doing it, but then there's other forms. So for example, if on a website it said, Mike Tung lives on the planet Venus, for example, let's say it said that on a website, right?
Yeah.
Now, you can't use consensus because there's nothing that's refuting that directly, really. But we can use ontological reasoning. So we know Mike Tung works at Diffbot. Diffbot is based in California. Mm-hmm. California is in the United States on the planet Earth. Venus is millions of miles away from planet Earth. So it's very unlikely that he commutes millions of miles from his home planet of Venus to his workplace, you know,
until Hyperloop. But
yeah, I mean, there's no other evidence of that in the knowledge graph statistically. There's no statistical support for that because there's no other people that commute millions of miles apart. So that's an example of where you have some statistical reasoning combined with there's like this very solid sort of high confidence chain of like planet Earth to Diffbot, right?
And right
in terms of edges in a graph, right? And so how do you like, so there's a lot of heuristic sort of methods, right, is what I'm saying, but no one's developed like the well-principled theory for how to fuse these disparate things together yet.
It kind of feels like, you know, you quickly hit philosophical bedrock, like looking into these things, because ultimately it's not, you can have a conversation that sounds like it's about ontology, but in reality, it's about epistemology. It's like, it sounds like, in other words, you know, for people who aren't like philosophical nerds, like it sounds like you're talking about the way things are rather than the way you find out how things are, which is the kind of deeper question and the bigger challenge, I guess.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, we view the internet as basically like the world's largest sensor, but it's a very interesting sensor. It's very different than like a radio telescope or a LIDAR or anything like that, in that it's a sensor that's biased towards what humans care about. So when humans care about something a lot, they make a page for it on the web. And so it's sort of like, it reinforces sort of like a lens into like the facts basically as people see them.
Yeah.
And then it's like, how do you then fuse that together to arrive at some sort of objective model of the world, which is what a knowledge graph is.
And then I guess there are also selection effects too, right? Because like I imagine, you know, if you look at Twitter, like the people who are loudest on Twitter are not the people who have, you know, they're not a statistically relevant sample.
Yeah. Well, that's an argument against purely voting is not going to be, not going to necessarily, you know, help you arrive at the truth the best.
Well, that's all fascinating. And again, like so hard to avoid these kind of philosophical questions. And that's one of the things I love about this space as a whole, and especially people who are looking at new ways of thinking about thinking, new ways of making these algorithms. So Mike, thanks so much for joining us for this. Do you want to share any links to your personal website or like maybe a blog that Diffbot has?
Sure. I would say the best place to find out about the company is just diffbot.com, diffbot.com. For the academics, I would check out our release knowledge net, which is like an open source benchmark data set for building your own knowledge graph from text.
For people who are interested in knowledge graphs, is there a good introductory resource that you'd recommend?
Yeah, I could send you a link to there's like a pretty good survey paper on knowledge graphs.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, okay. That I could direct folks to. There's also the Knowledge Graph Conference, which I think brought a lot of the community together, which, you know, I spoke at in the past before. And there's also been a Stanford sort of graduate course on knowledge graphs that had a lot of good speakers and videos. That's good. It's a good starter resource too for folks.
Fantastic. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, exciting times ahead in this in this space. And thanks so much for sharing all your thoughts about this.
Yeah, I had a lot of fun, Jeremy. This has been a great conversation.